Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 10th of November. Children discovering the wonders of nature while restoring rural landscapes, protecting endangered species, and creating city habitats. Classroom buildings are becoming living labs for energy conservation and resource stewardship. The young people in school today will inherit a host of pressing and escalating environmental challenges. Threats of climate change, loss of biodiversity, the end of cheap energy, depletion of resources, environmental degradation, and inequities in standards of living. So, the book that we're about to talk about this hour has decided to work to change all of that and create schools where children are tackling those problems, where the buildings are environmentally sound, and where some remarkably interesting things are happening. The Center for Eco-Literacy is a public foundation in Berkeley, California, that's dedicated to education for sustainable living. And the book that they have out is Smart by Nature, Schooling for Sustainability. Lisa Bennett is communications director for this center, a former fellow at Harvard University Center on Press, Politics, and Public Policy in the John F. Kennedy School of Government. She's written for many publications, including the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor, and the Chronicle of Higher Education. And she's currently writing a book about overcoming obstacles to action on climate change. We'll be welcoming phone calls because I know there are schools in Wisconsin that have environmental education programs. There are schools in Wisconsin that have green buildings that are doing wonderful things in terms of energy conservation, in terms of how the places are heated and air conditioned, and in terms of gardens right next to the schools. So if you have a green place and a special program you would like to highlight, feel free to call us 800-486-8655. And Lisa, we're happy to welcome you. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Bold new movement, K through 12 education. A tiny movement, is it, Lisa, or is it a fairly big movement?
Well, it's a growing movement. I would say it's somewhere in between. I mean, we've been at this work ourselves at the Center for Eco-Literacy for about 20 years now, and it was certainly a very tiny and contained movement at that time. But over the past couple of years, you know, we have just seen schools popping up across the country, and the book features schools in about 15 different states, mm-hmm. Just to provide a sampling. So I think it's, you know, the important thing is it's a movement. It's not an overwhelming movement, or else everybody would have heard of it, but it is a movement that is so on the verge of really exploding, I think, because what we see are that these schools are all doing it on their own. You know, this is not a top-down kind of thing. It's a change in awareness that is causing many schools to take this on their own.
And why don't you talk more about the environmental challenges these students will face, that we'll all face, but the students will live with them longer than we will in the coming decades. They're profound, aren't they?
Well, they are certainly profound. And, you know, as I've gone around talking to young people and getting a little bit of a sense of what their perspective is on it, it really can be quite heartbreaking. Recently, I met a young man, he's about 15 years old, and you know, he was the kind of kid that you thought had everything going for him. He was smart, he was articulate, you know, he was confident, but what he didn't have going for him was a belief in his future. He really saw climate change as something that was just going to devastate his generation's experience. And he was already thinking, oh, gosh, you know, I guess the best I can do is move to the middle of the country. He lived on the coast. Of course, that was kind of a naive, you know, approach.
Right.
But it indicated just how heavily these issues can weigh and do weigh on many young people today.
Mm-hmm. So,
and if I can talk about the reason why we think schools are essential, you know, the essential place to play a role in it, it's because they need to have a new way of viewing the world and of seeing not only all the terrible stuff that's happening and being reported on in the news, but the, you know, hopeful new developments as well.
Right. Oh, you have to have that. We all have to have that.
Exactly. Or, you know, how do you get up in the morning?
Right. You wouldn't be able to do it. Let's take on the issue in a small way, but this is a huge issue. The book deals with the area of food in schools. And it's really a large area when you think about it. Maybe it seems small, but it certainly isn't, because it has to do with sustainability and the health of our children, and it takes in obesity and all of those issues. You highlight some schools where farm fresh produce is making its way, lo and behold, to the lunchroom table.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and not only, you know, is it making its way through these connections, these farm to school projects, of which there are about 9,000 programs now countrywide, where schools are connecting to the local farms, that produce is going directly to the school, which is just a brilliant solution, because what it enables the farmer to do is to count on a local, you know, sizable customer. So that can make the prices manageable to the school and help the farmer as well. And there's one school that I always think about. It's on Lopez Island in the state of Washington. And there it was a case where a local mom who was a farmer had an extra greenhouse on her hands, and she decided to donate it to the school along with a little bit of money to support a farm-to-school coordinator. And, you know, the kids started growing their own food. It got into the kitchen. It got into the lunch programs. And one day, nobody ever believes this, but one day when the football team happened to be there and they were served this fresh food for one of the first times, they stood up and they gave a standing ovation to the kitchen staff.
Oh, that's
so
great.
You know, they appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, it's such an important thing that needs to happen in schools, and I'm wondering if this is a case where we do need some top-down organizing in terms of from the administration on this particular issue, to take on the issue of healthy foods in classrooms all over the country. It's great if students can start it or parents can start it, but what about everybody having this?
Absolutely, Kathleen. I think you're so right, because, you know, the thing that schools wrestle with, of course, so much is the money to pay for this.
Right.
And the schools that are making lunch for kids, they just are not getting enough money, generally speaking, to provide healthy lunches. So they have to get the food they can afford, which is often not the best.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bill that's in front of Congress right now, and there's a lot of talk about wanting to increase the amount of reimbursement that goes to the school to pay for lunches for just that reason.
There was even a school that you highlighted, the Davis Farm to School Connection, where the voters taxed themselves for farm to school
mm-hmm.
produce.
Mm-hmm.
They thought it was so important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, you know, there's a great body of research now that, you know, I think we can all recognize just through common sense that there's a connection between food and good health. But what research is also showing us is that there's a positive connection between good food and academics. So, you know, kids who have better nutrition are able to perform better.
Right. You keep hearing, we have way too many of these tests in my mind, but have a good breakfast before you take yet another standardized test.
Right.
So you'll perform well. Tell me about some of the book highlights some absolutely gorgeous structures that are schools that are made from recycled materials.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a school called the Willow School. There are really schools all over the place that, at this point, I believe the number is about 2,000 schools nationwide that are certified as green or on their way to being certified as green. The remarkable thing I think about that is that that's up from 1,200 just a year ago, which is rather remarkable when you think about the economy
right.
that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the schools are using old barns, and, you know, they're trying to develop not only positive use of energy resources so that they can help bring costs down, but also foster more connections to the natural environment throughout them, you know, surrounding the school.
Mm-hmm.
So there's more daylighting. So there's, you know, where some schools are lucky enough to be near a forest, you can see it from the school instead of it just being all closed off.
And what about the curriculum? The schools that you highlight have, because you can make math can deal with this, your English class can deal with this in some way. Is sustainability a part of all of the classes?
Well, it really varies from school to school, but it is possible, in our opinion, to be a part of all of the classes. And the best case in point that I know about that, and I know of that, is a school in Oakland, California, called the Hedroy School. It's been around for quite some time. I believe it was founded in the days of Grover Cleveland. And it is a school that just a few years ago changed its mission statement for the very first time in that history to put green in it. And, you know, that doesn't happen easily when a school's been around for that long. But this school felt like this was really the issue of the times for education, and it's a leading school, so it's important that it made that statement. And what they did was they actually worked with the Center for Ecoliteracy to incorporate the ecological perspective in every single course, and you know, from art to math, of course, to science. And it doesn't mean, you know, an impossible challenge of throwing everything out and, you know, starting over again. What it really means is just seizing the opportunities to bring in an ecological perspective. For example, in the art class, elementary level art class in that school, the teacher had the kids run around campus, take paper out of the recycling bins, shred it, learn how to turn it into pulp, and then turn it into this beautiful paper quilt. And then they had a discussion about, you know, the idea that learning to be a sustainable society means being able to, means, among other things, being able to take something that people might have discarded and make something beautiful out of it.
Isn't that wonderful? That's just, and then you feel that connection too. And unless you experience it in some way, you don't feel it. You just feel this connection with the place where you live, with the planet, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I think you're really getting to maybe the heart of it all, which is giving young people that opportunity to spend time in nature. You know, I mean,
right.
That in itself, in the educational environment, can have such a profound effect. You know, from a parent's perspective, I think a lot of us recognize that kids generally love being outdoors if they haven't gotten to an age where they haven't had the experience, you know?
Right.
And when they spend time outdoors and learning about it and observing it, all that natural curiosity can come up. And then caring about it is a natural byproduct rather than hitting them over the head, you know, to worry about all the issues that we know of.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, Lisa. We're talking about Smart by Nature, Schooling for Sustainability. And our guest is Lisa Bennett, Communications Director for the Center for Ecoliteracy, which, as she said, has been around for some 20 years. It's dedicated to the education for sustainable living. And the book looks at the accomplishments of sustainable schools, how they got started. It highlights schools where farm fresh produce is coming right to the lunchroom, where there are gardens next to schools, where recycled materials have been used to build schools, where sustainability is built into the curriculum, and much more. We welcome your phone calls. We have a full line already, but we'll have openings eventually. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Lisa and Daryl from Bloomington, our first caller. Hi, Daryl.
Yeah, hi, Lisa and Kathleen. I've been thinking about this for many years now, and I really believe that if we educate the youth in the schools, and you can use applied math, applied science, applied physics, and it could be a little bit like a vo-tech school curriculum, but they could apply it to their own homes, and they take that information as far as doing house heat gain, heat loss. You can do the ductworks systems, and all that stuff can be used, and math and science and physics works into it perfectly. And then the children would motivate the adults. And right now, we don't have anything going on locally. Actually, household energy use can be cut in half in most homes, and they'll still have everything that they need and be just as energy efficient as they are now. They won't lose anything, in other words. I've been an air conditioning contractor for, about 36 years, and I know all the different ways that, you know, you can reduce home energy use, and it would literally transform America. And then you can also educate them to go green, and that would just change the economy and change the whole thinking of America and the direction that we go.
Lisa.
Well, I certainly couldn't agree with you more, and, you know, I think one of the things that your comments are suggesting is, you know, there is a real back-to-basics kind of common sense possibility in this whole movement where there is that kind of information about how to take care of one's own things in one's life and, you know, self-sufficiency that once was more of our ethic, and I think in this movement is becoming more again, and we're going full circle, which provides just the kind of opportunities that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it interesting, and common sense is such an apt phrase here, some of the things that our parents and certainly our grandparents did every single day, we're just learning, oh, yeah, that was a good idea.
Right. I think so. And, you know, I met a teacher in Oregon who works in the public school, the high school public school in the suburb called Clackamas. And he's just like, you know, Daryl in a way, that he had this knowledge. He grew up with it. His father taught it to him. And, you know, he was then introducing these young people to all kinds of basic practices through the new lens of sustainable practices.
Right. Thanks so much, Daryl, for your call. John from Germantown. Hi.
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 I know you guys haven't addressed this at all, but I had actually started this project it must have been late 70s, but I bought the land for it. But what I was going to do is, it's an underground structure, and some of the schools I heard had done this, but a guy named Mac Wells had written a book about it back in the 60s, and then in the 70s, Rob Roy and a bunch of other guys wrote books on it, but they've got... Oh, universities have done tremendous things with storing heat, taking tubes and taking the heat from the summer and storing it underground. And down in Texas, in the hill country, putting houses underground and cooling them naturally, having light towers and natural light everywhere. So it looks even actually brighter than many above ground structures. The front of it looks like an above ground house, so you can't even tell that it's underground. You walk up to it and you go, oh my, it's got that curb appeal. You know, it's so popular. And then in that structure, I'm going to put in the stuff that Will Allen, I don't know if you've heard of Growing Power, but he's doing all this stuff. He's doing the urban aquaculture. He's doing hydroponics, just like in where I learned it was in Disney. You know, it's funny, in Disney World in Epcot, they have this tour, and that just blew my mind. They had the fish farm down there and the hydroponics. I was going, oh, my God, I could do this, right? You know, in a house, you know. And so I'm going to do all this stuff and then put it all together, and then I find out Will Allen is doing this right downtown. But, of course, you know, I thought of this years before. But this is – and then what I'm going to do now I've focused and I'm going to build a center where I can teach people how to do it. I'm going to learn from Will Allen, and I'm going to – build a phase of it underground and show people how you can actually build an underground house and it's not cold and damp and da 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 da, you know, and light,
right.
And you know, it's light and it's not dark and it's not a cave and no, you're not buried, you're not going to be, it's not your grave, you know.
Oh, I love your enthusiasm. And Will just got a large grant, I think, to do a lot of his work in Africa too, didn't he, John?
Yes, he did.
Yeah,
he's just a god. He is so
he's
good.
Amazing.
I mean,
Will.
The guy is unbelievable, the energy and the things he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
He has worms that take the mulch and digest it, worm beds, and then he can make the protein from the worms and feed the fish and feed the waste from the plants, feed the waste from the plants, you know, clean the water, and then the water from the fish waste is processed by the plants, and the worms take care of the in-between. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, Lisa, talk about sustainability. There it is.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm just enjoying actually listening to John's energy and talking about it.
It's great.
There are so many great ideas out there that, you know, everybody can share. And, you know, the young people who haven't yet been weighed down by some of these issues, they also have just tremendous creative ideas that we can learn from as well.
Mm-hmm.
So foster this in the schools then means that we're helping nurture a generation that will only give us more positive ideas.
Right. Thank you so much, John, for your call. David is next from Ironwood. Hi, David.
Hello. This is from a philosophy point of view. I would say truth, love, and freedom to live by. But freedom, not only do you need to know truth and self-control, but you need resources, and this is where sustainability comes in. I mean, if you have two people, only resources for one, you're in a lot of trouble, and you need to use the resources wisely and sustainable and stuff, because without enough resources, democracies will fall. I mean, just think about it. This is key for the United States liberal democracies to continue. We have to live sustainable. Otherwise, it's going to fall into totalitarianism.
Lisa?
Well, I don't feel confident talking about the political implications of it, but I certainly would say that, you know, what we're all facing is this basic conflict between a limited amount of natural resources on which we depend and ever-growing needs. So there is a tremendous fundamental conflict, and that is what the movement toward sustainable living is about addressing.
Mm-hmm. Let's highlight a couple other places. You write in the book we're talking about, from a modest trailer in Portage, Wisconsin, Victoria Rydberg has seen at-risk middle school students' interest, attendance, and test scores soar since she chose to focus on environmental sustainability. And then you write about another K-12 teacher who teaches at an independent school in Oakland, California, who has observed her students challenging their ideas about their world and their place in it since she put a sustainability perspective into history and politics classes. Can you talk about those teachers or other teachers you've met along the way in putting this together?
Sure. You know, the teacher in Portage, Wisconsin, which is about 40 miles north of Madison, her name is Victoria Rydberg, and she's very interesting because she was somebody who was just out of college. She needed her first teaching job, and she basically talked her way into becoming the teacher at this new experimental school. It was a charter school, and it was designed to try to address a basic problem, which was that there were a lot of middle school kids in that area who were at risk of flunking out. And they wanted to test an idea there because there had been some research that showed that when you engage students in the natural environment, they do tend to perform better academically because they're engaged, you know, and they see the relevancy and their natural curiosity comes out. So she became the sole teacher at this particular school. It was a two-room trailer.
Goodness.
Yeah. Out behind the back of, you know, the high school, and there she was on her own with, you know, almost half the population at-risk kids. And she did not know the first thing about sustainability or ecology. So what, you know, I thought was very appealing was that the way this was set up, one would think was a complete setup for disaster. Because she had quite a challenge on her hands, and she didn't have the knowledge when she started. And the reason I think that's important is because there are a lot of teachers out there who have been teaching something else, and they haven't been teaching sustainability, you know. And now when you start talking about there being a need for schools to integrate that, that reflects a new set of knowledge for them as well. And what Victoria, this particular teacher, did was she just set out to learn along with the kids. So every time they would ask a question, she had this response, which was, I don't know, let's find out. And, you know, it allowed her to grow on the job, but it also taught them, you know, self-sufficiency in learning themselves. And she, of course, went on from there and did all kinds of remarkable things, connecting with some of the local organizations that had quite a bit of knowledge, the Aldo Leopold Foundation and the International Crane Foundation and others, and she'd connect kids with these organizations, get them engaged in all kinds of projects, restoring prairies and building rain gardens. And in case after case, what happened was that the students had a challenge, a real challenge in front of them. You know, how do you build a rain garden? What?
Sure.
Well, it required them to figure out what's the purpose, how do you do it, how do you collaborate. It was a very real-world experience. And that challenge engaged them more across the board in their studies so that their grades started going up and the D students became B students.
Thanks for your call, David. We go to Kathy from Mukwonago next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Good, good. I shouldn't really be a spokesman for this school, but my grandchildren go there, and it's called, I don't know if it's Prairie Waldorf or Waldorf Prairie School,
mm-hmm.
and it's located over in Delafield, and they spend the first couple of years outside. They have a chicken coop. They take care of, they, you know, share the chicken coop work. I think it's the third grade that do chicken coops, and they always build projects, and each child has their own cup for their water. They're not allowed plastic, and there's no computers or calculators. And these kids learn to think. They teach them how to think, to problem solve, and they know so much about nature. And I mean, it's a wonderful school. And I just, when you were talking about all these schools and stuff, I just thought, oh yeah, that would be so great if they knew about this school. Because, and it's a private school, but it's just amazing out there. And I wish I had more knowledge so I could tell you. As long as I'm on the radio, I wish I could tell you more stuff, you know. But, and the teachers are very dedicated teachers. And each child, when they start out, they learn all the different things that the school has, rules and stuff, and there's discipline. But it's that nature thing that they learn so much about the world and organic and things
mm-hmm.
like that. So I recommend it highly.
Mm-hmm. Lisa?
Thank you, Kathy. And I would also ask if you're willing to pass it on. I believe you said it was your grandchildren.
Yes, she did.
There's a website that we will be newly launching at the end of this week, where we invite schools to put up their own stories. You know, because there is so much of this going on, and we know we're not documenting all of it. So if the Waldorf school there is interested, they could come to our website and tell their own story of what they're doing and share that with others.
And what is that again, Lisa?
It's www.ecoliteracy.org.
Ecoliteracy.org. Great. Okay, thanks. That would be good thing for her to do. And you talk about a woman who just had no idea what sustainability mm-hmm. was and learned on the job. And is that where most of this movement is coming from, just from people who are interested, from teachers, from students, from concerned community people? Who has the impetus to get these going?
Yeah, it's a little bit of all of the above. I mean, that case, I think, was a little bit different because she fell into this
right.
Challenge in a rather dramatic way. Others get into it because they just simply feel the urgent need to address these issues and help prepare young people for the challenges and really give them something positive to do. You know, one teacher said to me that, he said that their motto was something like, don't just worry, plant something. You know, that there are so many environmental issues we can worry about. But when you focus it on it from that perspective, young people especially, but all of us really, tend to just close down. And if you engage them in projects like, you know, taking out plants that are not native to an area and restoring them with the native plants that are better for the local ecosystem, or just, you know, planting new trees and being able to come back when they have children themselves and see how those trees have grown. Now, that just has its own legacy.
Right.
So there are those who are doing it out of their own, you know, need, because they think it's so important because of what they're seeing in the young people. And sometimes it's inspired by the students. At the school that I mentioned in Oakland, California, the spark kind of happened when a student walked into the headmaster's office and said that, you know, he wanted to really start doing something around green issues. And that's where it began.
Right. Let's go to Jessica from Stevens Point. Hi, Jessica.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I am an environmental education outreach specialist with the Wisconsin Center for Environmental Education here at UW-Stevens Point.
Great.
And we offer courses for teachers that are looking to bring a little bit of the environment into their classroom. So I thought this was rather fitting. As a matter of fact, Victoria Ryberg was a graduate of our program. And so hearing you talk about all her wonderful work was great. So I just wanted to mention that. I'm also a very active parent, and my son goes to a local neighborhood elementary school here. And we have a big group of parents that got involved from a interest in putting more of a natural playground in the area to get the kids outside and into that. We're within a city, you know, and we do have the Boston School Forest and things like that, but it's nice to have it every day outside.
Mm-hmm.
So, and
tell me more about the kinds of courses that you're offering for teachers who want to put this in their programs.
Yes. Well, as a matter of fact, I'm just typing up an email for all our online environmental classes that we're doing this spring. But we have a full master's program, as well as we have the LEAF program, which is the K through 12 forestry education program within the center. The KEEP program, which is the K through 12 energy education program. And they have courses throughout the state in local school districts. There's also the environmental education training program courses, more online courses that we offer through university.
Mm-hmm.
And they range. There's a large variety of topics that are covered. Like I said, energy and forestry. We also just have environmental education readings in environmental education and ecological basis.
Mm-hmm.
Environmental education, and on.
Great. Send us more info, would you please,
great,
on your programs? That would be
certainly
something we'd want to highlight down the road. Oh, it's a tiny world, isn't it, Lisa? I love this. It's so great.
In good ways.
Yes, in good ways. In good ways. Thank you, Jessica,
Thank you so much
for your call. Wayne from Columbia, Missouri. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks very much for asking. First off, I'd like to compliment the first caller, Gerald from Bloomington. It's really pleasing to hear a gentleman who is in the air conditioning and HVAC, I guess, industry, who's been interested in that in this so much. While I was listening, however, there were a couple of questions I had that. Number one, how much of the information are proactively getting out to school systems, public school systems around the country, and is that is there any way of coupling public school systems with local farmers? I worked for a while as a market manager for a farmer's market, and it seems to me that in what's going on here might be a real good connection between the two of them. And having said all that, also, I was wondering, I heard about, going back to one of your earlier callers, I heard about a thing called a hay bale house, I believe, where the walls are, the insulation is made out of hay bales, and I hope I'm right. But anyway, it was an alternative kind of insulation that was low cost, worked very well. However, as I understand, there are some barriers to overcome in the public government sector, and I was wondering if you could comment on those things. I'll take my call off the air.
Thanks, Wayne. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, Wayne. Those are all good questions. You're first about how much of this information is proactively getting out to the public schools. You know, that's exactly the business that we're in, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to be on this program to try to share some of that. There are not a lot of national organizations doing this work. There are just a handful. But as we heard from the prior caller, there are a lot of local and statewide organizations that are fostering environmental education. The need, however, to talk to public and independent schools, I think, is really important to raise the awareness that this kind of education is something that people think is important. And I think that's where everybody can speak up, especially parents in the school systems, and, you know, ask questions, is this being done? And maybe, you know, point them to this book or point them to our website or to somebody else's sources. So that's the first question. As far as coupling these efforts with local farmers, there are a lot of great things going on that way. As I mentioned earlier, there are about 9,000 programs nationwide connecting schools and local farmers, and there are just so many benefits there, certainly to the local economy, also to a sense of community for young people so that they can learn that very basic lesson about sustainability, which is, you know, we're all in this together.
Right.
And we say, you know, sustainability is a community practice. Mm-hmm. So, yes, that's going on, and there is a farm-to-school program. If people were interested, it's farmtoschool.org to find out more about that. As far as the hay bale house question, I'm afraid I do not know the answer to that one.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about disparity in income levels in all of this discussion. So I'd like for you, if you can, Lisa, to highlight perhaps some of the urban schools or the rural schools that don't have as much money as some private schools may have. In the intro to the book, you say that lower income and minority children suffer disproportionately from problems that schools often exacerbate: nutrition-related diseases from poor school food, we've talked some about that, respiratory problems related to poor air quality in school buildings, and the effects of exposure to chemicals and pesticides leading to a whole host of problems, diminished learning, etc. Can you highlight some schools that have become sustainable in those kinds of settings to take on those significant problems?
Yeah, it's a very strong and important point, and I think while we see that both public, and independent schools are doing this, and both the better off and the lower income schools are doing this, it is true that there's an income disparity that's at work in this. However, there. You know, if I can go back to the example of Victoria Rydberg in River Crossing Charter School in Wisconsin, in Portage, it's one of the best examples because they really didn't have any money. It, you know, was this two-room schoolhouse, and it was a matter of sheer creativity to take the kids and, you know, pick up the phone and call some of the local environmental groups and allow them to have experiences with those very professional, skilled, you know, knowledgeable organizations and benefit in that way. And it didn't cost the school anything. And what it did do was, you know, I mean, they learned there from experience that when a request was made to a community organization on behalf of young people, very often those organizations said yes. And so I think that was really quite an effective way to, you know, deal with the economic challenges and be creative about it, and it didn't, right. didn't cost them any more money.
Yeah, you can't underestimate creativity. It's great. Lisa Bennett is our guest. The book is Smart by Nature, Schooling for Sustainability. Lisa is Communications Director of the Center for Eco-Literacy, which is based in California. It's a public foundation dedicated to education for sustainable living. Our number is 800-486-8655. One line is open if you'd like to take it. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period... Tomorrow, actually, you can add to your knowledge and use this during the day, is, I believe it's the actual date of Abigail Adams' 265th birthday. And so we thought the occasion was most appropriate to celebrate her birthday. We're going to talk with the author of Abigail Adams. So that'll be fun. Back to phone calls for Lisa. Craig, Minneapolis. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Doing very well. Say, I'm a ardent fan of Wisconsin Public Radio in Minneapolis.
Great.
Say, I was calling because there's a little group up out of Solon Springs in Gordon, Wisconsin, that is called Canoes on Wheels. And they're kind of they have a program. It's called Friends of the St. Croix Headwaters. And what they realized was is that the people that lived up there year-round, the children, they didn't have access to canoes, so they couldn't get out onto the water to see what was going on. In the wintertime, they'd drive their snowmobiles on it. And so they set up a program to work with the local schools, so they have a trailer, 8 canoes, and they set up curriculum so that they're able to bring the children, the kids, they're 9 through 12, out onto the water and see what's there in the summer, helps them identify, you know, invasive plants. They actually participate in programs that deal with, like, freshwater mussel studies, those kind of things. So, on a, you know, part of this is on a learning curve is just to get the people who live in the area to see exactly what they have. And I was just surprised that getting out on the water was so difficult because you naturally assume
sure.
everybody's got a canoe.
Right, right.
You know, and these kids just, you know, they had found out that no one had been out really on the water in a canoe looking at the environment in which they live in.
Hmm. Lisa.
Yes, Craig, I love the point about the, you know, learning curve of getting people out right where they are. And, you know, I often think that what we're all in the midst of this extraordinary learning curve right now that all the environmental challenges have brought to bear. You know, we need to learn how to do things differently. So there's a learning curve opportunity for us as adults as well as for the children. So that sounds like a great project. It also reminds me of a story from one teacher. I know there are many who do this, but one teacher in particular who took his students out to a local body of water every year to study the water quality. Now, that's pretty common in a lot of schools, but he took it one step further, and he had them present their findings to the local government. And he did this every year, and the remarkable thing was that, you know, it worked both ways. It helped empower the students because they found that, lo and behold, the adults actually listened to them, but it also helped get something done. Because when the local government authorities were hearing from these students year after year, you know, they took the issue seriously.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, it so much of it, you know, is just surprising on just such small things that prevent people from enjoying their environment, like just making the assumption that, you know, everybody has access to canoes. And they
mm-hmm. 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 Right.
Right.
Thank
you. And, you know, a lot of it's about changing habits. Too. And, you know, we know that there's been a trend of people spending more time indoors over recent decades. So I think we're beginning to see some of a shift in that regard as well.
Thanks, Craig. What do you make of this? I don't know if there's any scientific evidence or empirical evidence or what here, but what do you make of reports that we've been hearing that in tough economic times in this country, we tend not to be as environmentally aware, and I'm wondering if that also means we're less concerned about putting this into our schools, et cetera, that we seem to want to hold on to the old way of doing things.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it's true. We have seen that in recent polls that show as people have become more concerned about the economy, concerns about things like global warming or climate change have gone down. And the, you know, the issue as to whether what effect that might have on schools and on environmental behavior in general, I think the jury's still out on that one, because there is a growing awareness of the connection between environmental issues and economic issues. You know, they're not two separate things. How we treat the environment has its economic implications. And, you know, how we rebuild the economy right now, there's a lot of opportunity in green jobs and green industry in that regard. So I think there is a growing awareness of the connection there. So I'm still hopeful.
Kay from Mequonico. Hi.
Hi. Very nice program. I just wanted to say that about 40 years ago, we bought some property in Door County, 20 acres. There was nothing on it. And we have a large family, and every year we would go up there and plant trees. So now we have quite a few trees, and we started out just camping on the property, and eventually we built a cabin ourselves. And we decided from the get-go never to put in any electricity. So we have lanterns, and we haul in our own water, and we have a compost toilet. And I think I'm a grandma now, and this was when my kids were growing up. And so all the generations come up there now, and we get together, and I really think it's taught our children and our grandchildren a lot about just sustenance and,
oh, I'm
and
sure.
getting together. And on both sides of us are golf courses, which, you know, put so much poison into the earth. You know, and up in Door County, there's hardly any topsoil, so it goes right down into the water table. And so we've talked to the kids about that, so I just wanted to relate that. And I was so interested in the online courses that you mentioned. I'm a storyteller, and I'm trying to develop a model for storytelling in the environment for kids. If I would just go to your website for the university up there, would I get the information that you talked about a little while ago?
Now, that was the other person who
Stevens Point, right.
Oh, yeah. So I would have to just go to this, I suppose, to the Stevens Point website, huh? Or don't you know anybody?
I would assume you could get it there, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thanks very much. But I'm sure if she got your book, she could weave some stories from that as well.
There are a lot of stories.
There are a lot of stories in it. A lot of stories. Steve from Oshkosh, hi.
Good morning. Thank you both. Great show. I just wanted to share an experience that we've had over the last couple of summers, getting lots of public school, mostly, kids out sailing. My wife and I have been doing one-day crash course, like sixth-grade sailing with 60 or 80 or 100 kids in various communities around northeast Wisconsin.
Great.
And it comes from the notion that if kids sail, and if they at some point stay aboard a sailboat or something similar, like the last call or some low-energy scenario, that all the sort of pro-consumption propaganda falls away in a heartbeat. Like when an advocate says that we need 20% more power plants, if you've lived on a sailboat, you know that's not true, that we could live on a tenth the energy and have a very nice life.
Mm. That's so inspiring. And, you know, what I love is that it's that matter of giving people an experience, and especially giving young people an experience, and how powerful that is in contrast to, you know, all these ideas that are thrown about, as you're saying. And, you know, those kinds of experiences, I guess we all know ourselves, then stay with us for the rest of our lives.
Yes,
so,
they do.
That's very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful, Steve. Are you doing this in Milwaukee, too?
I haven't been, but I'd love to take it statewide. I'd like to take it nationwide, because I think, like New Zealand, where every kid learns to sail, as I understand it.
Really?
Our nation would be transformed if all kids had sailing competency. I sound like a missionary, but it could be bicycling, it could be cross-country skiing.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's a fantastic thing for kids.
Oh, I'm with you on that. I love to sail. Send us more information, will you?
I will.
Great. Thanks
Thank
so
you.
Much. Yeah, thanks, Steve, very much for the call. Well, we're plumb out of time, I'm afraid, Lisa. Thank you so much for being with us. Continued success. And
thank you so much for
for talking about it.
Yeah, our great pleasure. We had a good time. Thank you. Okay. Lisa Bennett is Communications Director of the Center for Eco-Literacy, and she has written for many publications, the New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, Chronicle of Higher Education. She is the co-author of Smart by Nature, Schooling for Sustainability, which has just been published by Watershed Media. So you ought to be able to – it's in paperback, too, which lowers the cost of books. So you ought to be able to find it. And it's a valuable resource for – and a look at what's going on in terms of schools and sustainability, creative ideas, not just ideas. They've been put in practice all over the country. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow. And a reminder, a celebration of – we should have cake, right? Abigail Adams' birthday, 265th birthday, is tomorrow. We'll talk with the author of a book about her life. This is the Ideas Network.